I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. His restaurants include the French Laundry, Per Se, Bouchon, Bouchon Bakery, and Ad Hoc. The French Laundry and Per Se hold 3 Michelin stars, and Thomas has won Best Chef Awards from the James Beard Foundation, among other accolades. He is the author of 4 cookbooks, including the French Laundry Cookbook. Welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
It took you quite a few years before you bought the French Laundry and your career really took off. You held various cooking positions in Florida, Rhode Island, Catskill in upstate New York. You apprenticed in France. You then went from your first restaurant called Raquel in New York City to another restaurant in Los Angeles. And finally, you landed in Yountville in the Napa Valley. How did you find the French Laundry?
I was in Los Angeles at the time. I was dating a woman who was a wine broker in Los Angeles. Of course, many of her wineries were in Napa Valley. So I would travel with her to Napa Valley probably twice a month. And at that time, there was a chef, a colleague, friend from New York City, Jonathan Waxman, who was opening his first restaurant outside of New York in California called Table 29. And during construction, I stopped by to see him one day on one of my trips. He knew I wasn't working. He said, Thomas, there's this restaurant in Yountville called the French Laundry, and I know it's for sale, and I think it'd be perfect for you. And so that was really the catalyst that started the process. And I went to Yountville. I walked on the property of the French Laundry and just emotionally resonated with me. I felt like this was the place.
By the way, this girlfriend, the wine broker, is this the woman whom you started an olive oil company with called Evo in 1992?
Exactly. Yeah, Diane Harder. Exactly. Mm. Diane and I started an olive oil company called Evo. It was a time when I wasn't working and I was trying to find other avenues from a culinary point of view where I could have an impact.
There's a quote in the French Laundry Cookbook which resonated with me. When you first discovered the French Laundry, you said, I gave the French Laundry a new life, and it gave me a new life. And that implies a level of sadness prior to the French Laundry. Was there sadness in your life or restlessness prior to that?
Well, there was certainly a great sense of uncertainty in my life. New York, when I was in New York at Raquel, you know, this city was my home. It was the center of the universe. I never thought I would ever leave New York City. I was emotionally and physically committed to Raquel. And, of course, when that failed, I was set adrift, didn't really know what to do. I spent a year in New York trying to find some connection to something, really didn't, and ended up in L.A. I went out there to be the chef at Checkers Hotel. A great hotel. We got great exposure. It was a great success. But ultimately, that was a failure for me. Mm-hmm. And then I was set adrift again in L.A., and I didn't really know what I was going to do. Was I destined to be a chef? Was I cut out to be a chef? As much as I love cooking, as much as I love the fact of nurturing people through food. So the French Laundry was kind of my last effort. Mm-hmm. If that didn't work, I'm not sure what I would have done.
Why do you think Raquel didn't work out?
There's a number of different things. Certainly, at that time in New York, which was the mid-80s, I mean, it was just booming. Americans were learning about French cuisine, about fine dining, and certainly Raquel was a version of that at that moment. Raquel was downtown in a new area, Hudson Square. My partner, Serge Raoul, who owns Raoul's, certainly had great experience in New York and certainly great experience downtown. I had just come back from France, learning about French food, living there, learning really in the detail of French food. And it was a great success for the first 4 years. I mean, the restaurant was 6 years old by the time we closed it. And then, of course, the area didn't develop as that was predicted to develop. We had certainly the stock market downturn. But I think one of the big reasons is I really didn't understand how to run a restaurant. And from that moment on, I knew that if I was going to have another restaurant, if I was going to be lucky enough to have another restaurant in my life, I needed to have individuals involved in that restaurant that knew more than I did about finance, knew more than I did about running a dining room. I was a chef, and a lot of chefs think they can do everything. I realized at that moment at Raquel, at great expense, personal expense, financial expense, that I didn't know everything I needed to know.
I've heard you say that one of the appeals to cooking is the immediate gratification that you get. But looking at your history, it seems like your life has been more of one of a patient gardener, a gardener who has to tolerate the erratic nature of the weather and other components out of one's control. What is your temperament?
It's interesting when you say patience. I learned patience relatively later in life, and a big part of that came to me when I was trying to put together the financial structure for the French Laundry and buying the French Laundry. I would call my attorney every day and ask him if there was any news. And finally, one day he said, "Thomas, listen, I'll call you when there's news." And I had to keep myself busy, and I had to learn to be patient. And then, of course, persistence. I mean, I sit here today as a true example of somebody who was persistent.
You talk about patience in the kitchen, and in your cookbook, the French Laundry cookbook, you talk about being mindful about cutting an artichoke. What are some other examples of your being mindful of the mundane in the kitchen?
Cooking is repetition, and I think that as cooks, you have to be comfortable with knowing that you're going to be doing the same thing your entire career. And of course, that's going to change and evolve, but at the basis of what you're doing, you're cooking, whether it's sautéing or braising or roasting or chopping or slicing or dicing, plating food. I mean, all the poaching, even the new sous vide technology that we're using in the kitchen, all those, once you've mastered them, once you've learned them, you're going to be doing them. They're part of the daily routine. They're part of your daily structure. Repetition, in many ways, liberates you to be working on other things. I mean, I've cleaned salmon so many times before that I don't really have to focus on cleaning the salmon. It's almost like muscle memory, and I can be thinking about more other things, like what am I going to do with the salmon when I get it cleaned?
Have you been influenced by any religion that has helped you be more mindful? Because you're talking as somebody who might do yoga or meditation, or even, you know, Judaism is about the present. So there's a lot of religious spiritual components to what you're talking about.
People have said that to me before. As a young boy, I went to Catholic school, and one of the things I did every day was be an altar boy at Mass, and that was something, 7 a.m. Mass, I was there, you know, 5 days a week, or 6 days a week, because then it was also Sunday. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really have much, later in life, I didn't have a strong connection to religion, and certainly meditation or any kind of spiritual enlightenment is not part of my... never been part of my life, really. So I'm not sure where it comes from.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur Thomas Keller. He's the first American chef to be awarded 3 Michelin stars for both of his fine dining restaurants, the French Laundry in Napa Valley, California, and Per Se in New York City. You spent your early life in California before moving to Florida. Your parents were divorced. Your father was a Marine drill instructor, and he left your mother when you were 5 or 6 years old with you and your 4 brothers.
Correct.
What influence did your father's absence in your life have on you?
My mother and father didn't have a very good separation, so they didn't part on friendly terms. So, you know, growing up, and I was 4 years old when they separated, so my whole life was with my mother and my brothers. Mm-hmm. My father wasn't really part of it. He was somebody who lived in Pennsylvania. I don't want to say I didn't have any need for him, but I didn't have an apparent need for him. I certainly had those father figures in my older brothers. They were my role models. They were my teachers, you know, from a masculine point of view. And my mother was there. My mother was an amazing person, very dedicated, committed to her children and their well-being. And she ran restaurants, so she was gone in many evenings, which left the older brothers, my older brothers, to kind of cook for us and babysit us, which was fine. But I didn't grow up on, you know, sitting on my mother's knees during the polenta or my grandmother's, you know, in my grandmother's kitchen, you know, baking biscuits. But as I started to grow older, I spent more and more time at the restaurant. And I really enjoyed those moments in my mother's restaurant, in those kitchens.
When you say your mother's restaurant, she was a restaurant manager of an existing restaurant
exactly.
in Florida.
She didn't own the restaurant. She ran the restaurants, yes.
What are some of those early memories that you have with her in the restaurant?
Well, you know, the restaurants are very nurturing places. And at the same time, kitchens can be very violent places. So you have this real dichotomy between these two environments. You have these individuals in there who are continuously cooking for people and nurturing them. But at the same time, you have sharp knives, you have wet floors, you have steam, you have heat, you have all these different things going on. So you really have to be aware in a kitchen. And I think awareness was key for me. And I think that was one of the great things I learned early on from my mother and being in those kitchens was a sense of awareness of everything that's around me and being careful.
Hmm. When you were with your mother in those earlier years, did you have thoughts of, this is where I want to make my life? When did that come to mature?
Well, I never thought about being a chef in those early days. When I did venture out on my own and have a job in the real world, which was in construction, my older brothers were in construction, so I kind of migrated towards that. But once I found my way back into the kitchen, and although I didn't realize it at that time, looking back at that moment, washing dishes at the Palm Beach Yacht Club really prepared me to be a cook, because the actions that you are doing as a dishwasher, the same things that you're going to be doing as a cook. In other words, it's about organization. So as all the dirty dishes and silverware and glasses come in, you have to be extremely organized. You have to have them stacked correctly. You have to have them piled. You have to have the water ready for the silverware. You have to be efficient. So you have to be able to stack the plates up correctly or get the silverware done correctly so that you're efficient in your movement, so you're not wasting any time. You get instant feedback. If you don't scrape the dishes correctly or spray them down correctly before they go in the dish machine, they come out dirty. Mm-hmm. And then you learn to be part of a team. And everybody in the restaurant relies on you. So those were four critical elements of being a really good dishwasher that you translate to being a really good cook.
Yeah. It was washing dishes that helped you realize, I can make a life in the kitchen. But you had a level of organization and almost compulsiveness for cleanliness and precision, even outside the kitchen, in your home growing up. Mm-hmm. Can you describe what you were like in your own home?
Well, my mother was meticulous. I mean, the house had to be clean all the time. And you take your shoes off before you went inside, at one point, I remember in my life, the furniture was covered in plastic wrap, to protect the fabric. We all had chores every week. My brothers and I always had chores. And Joseph and I, being the youngest, would always have to do the chores of the oldest. I was the one that always had to clean the bathroom, and that was probably the most difficult and certainly the most... You really became aware of how clean it was.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. We'll hear more from Thomas coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur, Thomas Keller. His restaurants include the French Laundry, Per Se, Bouchon, Bouchon Bakery, and Ad Hoc. The French Laundry and Per Se hold 3 Michelin stars, and Thomas has won Best Chef Awards from the James Beard Foundation, among other accolades. You weren't surrounded by, this rich culinary life growing up in any way. How did that transition occur from, washing dishes in a, random restaurant with your mom to actually acquiring this awareness of this whole other culinary world?
So if you think back at the Palm Beach Yacht Club, I was washing dishes. And one day my mother came to me and said, Richard, who was the chef at the time, Richard's going to leave in a couple weeks. So, if you watch what he does, we're going to make you the chef.
How old are you?
I was probably 19.
Okay.
And I thought, wow, this is interesting. But I did have a leg up. My brother Joseph was already in the profession. He decided at a relatively young age, 12 or 13, that he really wanted to be a chef. And Richard did show me. He showed me how to make an omelet. He showed me how to, grill a flank steak, make hamburgers, things like that. And that's really what basically it was. The most difficult thing I had to do every day was make a hollandaise sauce. And my brother Joseph was very influential in helping me do that.
But no formal training ever.
No formal training. But there was really not an option. There wasn't a lot of options back in 1974 for formal training. Cooking wasn't viewed as it is today. There was really not a whole lot of interest in becoming a chef.
You had the reputation of managing your kitchen as if you were a military marine drill instructor like your father. And it's almost trite to ask, mm-hmm. you know, what parallels are there between you and your father? But how has that occurred to you?
Well, you're right. I mean, absolutely. There is a definite hierarchy in the kitchen. That hierarchy was defined by Augustus Escoffier in the turn of the 1900s.
Is this the brigade system?
The brigade system, yeah. So you have a brigade or brigade. I mean, brigade in French, brigade in America. And I mean, there's you know, the hierarchy. There's the chef who's the leader. Then there's the sous chefs, demi sous chefs, chef de parties, commis. So you have this real hierarchy of how the kitchen operates. And when you think about a kitchen, especially during service or most of the time, it's about command response. And when you think about it, that initial command really comes from the guest. Mm-hmm. You sit down at the table, you look at the menu, and you choose what you want to eat. And you tell the waiter. And that's your command. Then all of a sudden, as the chef, then you tell all the chef de parties what needs to be done. And they respond. So from a militaristic point of view, it's the same in the military. It's all about command response.
Was it striking to you that, my career is paralleling my father's to a large degree?
It was a little bit. I didn't really think about it until much later in life. Much later in life, my early 20s, when I really started to think about it and I started to reach out to my father to reconnect with my father at that time in my life.
And when you did reach out to him, you really reconnected in a big way. Your father moved from Pennsylvania to California to be with you at the French Laundry.
Yes.
In Napa Valley. And he died after having a car accident about a year after?
About a year and a half after he arrived in Yountville. He had a horrific car accident that left him a quadriplegic. And that was one of the most challenging moments of my life is to prepare him to come home, his home in Yountville.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur Thomas Keller. He was awarded France's highest culinary decoration, the Légion d'Honneur, for popularizing French cuisine in America in 2011. So you found your home in the French Laundry, and it took you about 2 years to raise $1.5 million to get the restaurant off the ground. Who did you raise the capital from?
Yeah, it was $1.2 million. But, I mean, back then, that was, you know, I mean, when you don't have any money, you know, a substantial amount of money was an enormous amount of money to me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I went through three different avenues to raise the money. One was a commercial bank loan, real estate loan. Although I realized that once I started to apply for the bank loans, the failure here in New York City came to be a problem. So I had to have my old partner Serge Raoul, who really went out on a limb for me financially, come back and satisfy some of the debt that was still outstanding at Raquel. Mm. So, you know, when you think about the people that are involved in your life and how they come to your aid in some of the most unpredictable ways, I mean, certainly we had a failed restaurant. We had parted ways. I was gone for 3.5 years, and all of a sudden I need him to come back and satisfy a financial debt for us. And so, you know, that was one of the first individuals that, you know, really stepped up to the plate to help. The second part was a small business administrative loan. And we were very fortunate. I was very fortunate at that time. President Clinton had just come into office. He was trying to re-energize the economy. So he funded the SBA in a significant way. And, you know, a white, middle-class, educated male was not the profile for the SBA prior to that. And then finally, the last component was going out to private individuals for private placement. And I reached out to probably over 400 people. And that was probably the most difficult part of my life, trying to sell this project. And out of 400, we had 50 people who finally signed a check. And that was the final straw that helped me buy the French Laundry.
And the French Laundry in the 1880s, when it was first built, was actually a bar.
Before Prohibition, it was opened as a saloon gambling brothel. Yountville, in that time, we have a veterans home there, which is the oldest veterans home in America, or in California, I'm sorry. And then what happened really is the state really got tired of all the problems they were having in Yountville, so they passed a law that there wasn't a lot of alcohol served within 2 miles of the veterans home. So that shut down Yountville. And that's when a young French couple, bought the property. Yountville, Napa Valley at that time still was a place that many of the social elite from San Francisco would summer in. So their business model was to, you know, service all of these the socialites in their homes with the laundry service. And hence, that was where the French Laundry began.
After 10 years of French Laundry, you opened Per Se in 2004 in New York City. So you returned to the city that rejected you in the earliest days. How did that relationship with the Time Warner Center originate?
Time Warner Center was being developed by the Related Group. At that time, they were really looking towards France to come and occupy and build the restaurants there. At the same time, one or two of the French chefs that just arrived in America received some less than flattering reviews. So they kind of repositioned themselves and said, okay, let's not go to France. Let's look into America. And they reached out to me to see if I'd be interested in being one of their tenants. And I had looked at New York once in a while, you know, mm-hmm. through the history of the French Laundry. You know, people would always say, when are you coming home? You know, home being New York City. If I was going to do another restaurant, another fine dining restaurant, there's really no other city in America to do it. And the Time Warner Center really offered us an opportunity to do it in a significant way.
You had a charmed life with French Laundry, but Per Se had an inauspicious start. There was a fire which mm-hmm. set you back. Can you talk to me about
the
that
fire.
Episode?
We opened the restaurant on February 19th in 2004. A little less than 10 years after we opened the French Laundry. And we had closed the French Laundry and brought 30 of those individuals to Per Se to help inoculate and train the new team. So we were off to a great start. And then on that, the 26th of February, it was right at staff meal. And I was in the butcher room with two of my sous chefs and we were chatting. And we started to smell smoke. Then we started to see smoke. And that's when I evacuated the kitchen, the restaurant. We called the fire department. And that was basically what I thought was the beginning of end. And I stood there when that young fireman, you know, standing on top of the tables and just taking that big axe and going through the wall and the flame shooting out and water pouring out everywhere. And I thought, you know, I called my attorney and I said, I got to get out of here. But the next day we came back and, you know, we had a whole different attitude. We're going to now have a second chance to open this restaurant. And then I started getting cards from our Asian guests, and they were all flowers were coming and congratulations were coming because in Asia, if you have a fire in your kitchen, it means you're going to be successful. So it's just, it was a matter of point of view.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chef and restaurateur Thomas Keller. I want to talk about just the experience of dining in the French Laundry or Per Se. The menus change every day in both restaurants, and you've said that you don't repeat any ingredients in the 9 courses. Is that true?
We repeat luxury ingredients. So there may be truffles twice, or there may be foie gras twice, but we would never have mushrooms twice, or carrots twice, or turnips twice, or things like that.
Do you think the clientele would really mind?
Well, you know, at some point, you know, as much as we appreciate and work for our guests, it's really about us. You know, it's about our values and our standards and challenging ourselves. And it was really a challenge in the beginning. Okay, we're not going to repeat any garnishes, any vegetables. Why would we? We're the French Laundry.
And we're going to have a new menu every day.
Right.
Can you walk me through some of the items on your menus that you are particularly fond of?
Some of the signature dishes or some of the iconic dishes anyway, certainly the coronet of salmon. And what that is, it really looks like a miniature ice cream cone. And the inspiration from that ice cream cone, for that dish came from my experience eating ice cream cones.
At Baskin and Robbins.
Here in Chinatown, exactly. And that's where when you think about awareness, how important awareness is, because you can look at something every day or every week or experience something over and over again and never really realize the full potential of what that is. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until that day in 1991 when I was at Baskin Robbins and the ice cream cone was put in front of me, did I see the coronet.
How about the oysters and pearls, which is another iconic offering of yours?
Exactly. It's one of those iconic dishes that is prepared every day. It was a purple box. And I was walking down the aisle of a grocery store and I saw a purple box. And on the purple box it said, you know, pearl tapioca. And I'm thinking, where do pearls come from? Pearls come from oysters. And therefore, you know, I bought a box of pearl tapioca, took it back to the French Laundry, and knew exactly what I was going to do with it. And there we have oysters and pearls.
And there is a level of playfulness on the menu at Per Se, mm-hmm. which seems surprising perhaps to people who go because, this is a fine dining establishment and they might expect it to be stuffier than it certainly is.
if you've experienced macaroni and cheese before, I think, which we all have, we can reinterpret that in a way that's going to be significant, and you're going to go, wow, that's just like the best macaroni and cheese I've ever had. Mm-hmm. Coffee and donuts, is another one of those iconic dishes. And when you think about, yes, fine dining restaurants historically have always been intimidating, and it's something that I don't want to represent in our restaurants. And so when you get that cornet, I mean, you have to smile. It's just so darn cute.
The law of diminishing marginal returns is important to you, and the idea is when you are giving people their food, you give them just enough to keep it interesting before they move on to the next.
Exactly, exactly. And you think about the law of diminishing returns, and something came evident to me when I was a young person living in Florida, and we would go to the beach on Saturday and have beer. And that first cold beer on a hot summer day was really amazing, really refreshing, really good. And of course, by the time the second one came around, it was less, and the third one was even less so. I translated that into the way I thought about food.
There's a comedian, Louis C.K. He says, some people might eat until they're full and then move and then stop, but I eat until I'm ashamed. What are your own eating habits?
I try to eat healthy, of course. I don't try to eat a lot of food. I try, in the morning, it's very ritualistic. Typically, I'll have, some type of granola with chia seeds and some ground flaxseed, which I grind myself. Then I'll have my vitamin regimen with some juice or some probiotics, and then I'll have coffee. And then, throughout the day, I typically eat with the team at the restaurant. I'm meeting at 8 a.m. in the morning, at noon, and then again at 4:45, because that's when we serve our p.m. meal. So if I stay on that schedule, I feel really, really good.
I want to talk about your suppliers. You have more than 350 suppliers restaurant?
For the restaurant, yeah. Suppliers come and go depending on the season, depending on what they're growing, depending on where they are.
Can you provide some examples of your suppliers, some of the stories of your suppliers?
There are so many. Ingrid Benjes, who's in Stonington, Maine, who is accidental. I mean, she was an author. She moved to Maine, and she was trying to make a living. And she found some mushrooms and found a home for them at Balducci's here in New York. And they said, well, what else do you have? And she said, well, I'm from Maine. Maybe I can get you lobsters. And so that was almost 40 years ago, Diane St. Clair in Orwell, Vermont. She gets up every day, 7 days a week at 4 a.m. to milk the cows by 6 so that she can start making the butter, that she cultured the day before, make 20 pounds of butter a day.
Incidentally, I have to mention, I was reading New York Magazine recently, and there's this this piece on Per Se talking about, that trysts happen. You're working intensely with people, and you become intimate with them. That is true for you, too.
It is.
You hired Laura Cunningham, who was your restaurant manager, really
Correct.
Your first hire mm-hmm. at the French Laundry, and she's now your partner.
Exactly.
Can you describe that evolution?
Well, it's interesting. And we work so hard and so long, so many hours, and you're right. You really become intimate with the individuals that you're working with, in so many ways, and it's always kind of difficult when you begin a personal relationship with a coworker, mm-hmm. but no more so than with Laura and I. Because at the French Laundry, when we were both working at the French Laundry, every day together, we lived next door. It really became a true family kind of environment. I mean, if mother wouldn't let you do something, let's go ask father.
You have this reputation for being really very control-oriented. And in fact, you said a kitchen is about control at any level. But do you think you're any different from the top chefs? There's this element of
control.
Yeah.
We're control freaks. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, chefs, historically, I mean, by nature, are control freaks. They want to control. They need to control what's going on in their kitchen so that they're controlling what's going on in the dining room. We talk about emotional chefs, most chefs that have outbursts and, get upset. And where that comes from, I mean, the genesis of that is something happening that prevents me from giving you, the guest, the experience that I want. Because if something comes in the way of that, something clogs that, then there's a problem.
Have you in the past, like, worried, oh, you know, I'm not going to be very well liked if I'm going to be so control-oriented? Like, did you ever have to kind of grapple with that for yourself?
Yeah, you do. I mean, when I was younger, I mean, those emotional outbursts, you know, sometimes became personal. And you realize that that's not the way to operate. That's not respectful. And you ended up going back to the person that you had that emotional outburst. And you had to apologize to that person.
What's an example? We talk at 30,000 feet of, you know, your attention to detail and your control orientation. What's an example of that in the kitchen day to day?
Everything's about precision.
But what's an example?
Okay, an example is, let's take something as simple as knife skills. You know, cutting brunoise of vegetables. Brunoise of vegetable is something that's 1/8 of an inch square. Mm-hmm. You know, and being able to make sure that the mandolin that you have that slices the elongated piece of vegetable is really, really sharp and has the right calibration in terms of thickness. And then that's your knife skills, because then your knife skills come, because then you're slicing that long, thin julienne vegetable into a brunoise. Let's talk about quenelling.
What's quenelling?
Quenelling is having two spoons. And quenelling is something that we do in so many different ways. It's making something in the shape of an egg.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So a quenelle is something that's the shape of an egg. If you're quenelling sorbet or ice cream, you know, it really requires the sorbet or the ice cream to be a specific temperature. And it requires you to have a spoon that's clean and hot, so that when you move your spoon through the ice cream or sorbet, the sorbet just folds over itself and forms this perfect egg-shaped quenelle of ice cream. Or if you're using two spoons, when we're quenelling the caviar for the oyster and pearl, for example, making sure that you have enough caviar on the spoon and your spoons are clean and accurate, so that, and your movement back and forth to create this shape that you're then going to put on the dish, which is oysters and pearls, which is the first dish that our guests really receive, and something that's so impactful for them.
Do you have the same level of precision in your personal life?
Habits are really important. So I think it's important that you recognize a certain standard. And many of us, let's take a T-shirt, for example. You may have a little hole in your T-shirt, and nobody really sees it. So is it to your standard to know that you're wearing a T-shirt that has a hole in it? Or is your standard so that you know there's a hole in it, and it's not acceptable even to you, even though no one else sees it, and you get a new T-shirt?
And what is your standard?
New T-shirt.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been the chef Thomas Keller. Coming up, we'll meet Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. Prior to launching the company in February 2012, Peter was a Tony Award-winning theater producer. Welcome.
Great to be here.
What percent of the population is under 5'8"?
25% of American men.
So why hasn't a company like this existed prior? You know, you see a bunch of fashion designers actually who are 5'8 or under, like Giorgio Armani, Mickey Drexler, J. Crew.
I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, it's an enormous demographic. It's incredibly difficult to get dressed and find clothes that work. I think maybe it's because this consumer just didn't pipe up and say, what about me? You know, they manage, they go to the tailor, and it's dispiriting and no fun, but, you know, no one's walking around naked. I also think people thought, how do you do it? There's a stigma. And people have tried. I was speaking to a customer the other day who said, oh, we're so glad you're doing this. She's so happy and all that. And she said, there used to be a store in Washington that closed. And I said, oh, really? I don't know. But what store was that? She said, oh, it's called the Short Men Shop. And I was like, wonder why that closed. You know what I mean? I just don't think there's the way to do it. And I'm trying to do it in a new way.
Your company doesn't mention the word short anywhere. Is that a conscious decision?
Definitely. It is a stigma. It is a bummer in the world we live in. So why not sort of avoid it? I'm 5'8". I was having problems. I thought if I'm having, you know, issues, then definitely guys shorter will. You know, one of the funny things is men who are shorter, sometimes I'll tell them that I'm doing this, and they go, oh, really? That sounds interesting. You know, I do okay. And they'll sort of walk away. And then they'll come back and say, hey, you gonna do polo shirts?
What is so painful about making your pants a little shorter? What does it mean to have a company geared towards the 5'8 and under crowd? Is it just simply making shorter pants?
I don't think men want to shop. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to shop and then have to go for the second step of taking your clothes to the tailor. And also the proportion on things are wrong. So if you get pants shortened, they're still too wide at the ankle and they're too wide at the knee, and it makes you look shorter because your pants are too wide. So it's never quite right.
I heard that you wore a Brooks Brothers boys blazer for several years.
Yeah, you know, it's all true. I mean, men have had to, like, shop in the boys department.
What is a tailor tax?
I call the tailor tax the money, the extra money one pays to fix your clothes. You know, I've shortened T-shirts that are just too long, or polo shirts that are too long, or I've had to take sleeves in because they're just too wide. I mean, it's really a pain. Mm-hmm. If you care, mm-hmm. it's a pain, mm-hmm. and it's a lot of money. And if you don't care, you don't look good.
I noticed you talk about your clothes being inspired by, you know, New York City street life, like the subways, for example. What is it about the subway that inspired your design?
Well, it was about color. The mosaics in the subway, the subway signs, are these beautiful signs from when the subways were first made. Burnished reds and deep blues and kind of great sort of hunter green jewel tones. And, you know, there's a stop at 86th Street and a stop at Bleecker Street I call Bleecker Blue, you know, in my head, you know. So it's that kind of influence.
Now, you're still in the early days of the company. I mean, you launched in February 2012.
Oh, yeah, we're early.
So you're going through the process of defining and executing. And what has been harder for you than you thought, even not very far into the company?
Hard is getting your product made and done. And, you know, in factories that you're, you know, I'm a little pisher. I'm not a big gun yet. So you're not a priority, and how to make sure that you get the quality that you want, that's really a struggle.
The name of the company is eponymous, is Peter Manning. How did you ultimately come to that? Was it obvious, or?
I was talking to a branding firm that was helping me, and I came in into a meeting, and they said, your name is Peter Manning. People would pay us lots of money to come up with that name, and it's yours. In the early days, and still, I'll respond to a customer and they'll say, wow, it's you. And I'm like, sure, yeah, we all pick up the phone around here. There's no, you know, we all are helping. It's all hands on deck. So I think having someone behind it who's felt their pain and who wants the same clothes too is really makes a difference.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the clothing designer, Peter Manning. Peter is the founder of Peter Manning, an e-commerce clothing company for men 5'8 and under. You've had quite a career shift. Prior to starting Peter Manning, you worked in theater for over 15 years.
Yeah.
What drew you to theater initially?
I did start in the theater. I wanted to be an actor. But I loved it. I mean, growing up, I always did it, and I loved it. And then it got hard, and I wanted to see what the other side was about, because I didn't want to just sit around and complain about how, oh, there's no opportunities for actors and they don't really want me and all this stuff. I didn't like sitting around talking actor talk. And I got an internship at Manhattan Theater Club, and I worked there for 2.5 years and ended up saying, oh, producing. Mm-hmm. There's plays and there's this whole other side of it that I hadn't thought about.
You won a Tony Award in 1998 for Sideman, which was a show that you took to Broadway. A sideman is somebody who plays like in a jazz band, right? How would you just define what a sideman is?
A sideman is a guy who plays in a jazz band. He's a guy who plays for hire, you know, mm-hmm. so he can play in a big band there. He can play at a wedding. He can play, you know, he can play in an orchestra pit. He's just he's a journeyman musician. Yeah. And it was a play that I loved that I'd done at New York Stage and Film. When I left New York Stage and Film, I told the writer, Warren Light, I promised him that I would do the play in New York. I had no idea how I was going to do that. And every producer in New York had seen Sideman and turned it down. I knew that it would be a success. I just knew it in my bones.
How much of your memory does that project consume in your era of theater?
It was an incredible experience for so many of us. And part of it, just as we were moving from downtown to Broadway, our daughter was born. So it's sort of tied up in that as well. But Frank Wood, who played the father, was this journeyman actor who'd sort of been like a sideman, but an actor, because actors are like sidemen too. And he went on to win the Tony Award. Edie Falco played the mother before. I remember Edie Falco telling me at some rehearsal one day, going, "Oh yeah, I got the show. It's The Sopranos." I remember vividly thinking to myself, "Wow, God, Edie sure doesn't seem like the sort of taffeta dress singing type." Because I thought it was – I had no idea. I mean, that's – so we were all kind of young and doing this thing we just believed in with all our heart. And it kind of – you know, you have this experience where you sort of put it together with tape and love and, you know, hope for the best. And we're, everyone's working for nothing in a, conditions that are like, you know, almost tawdry. And you sort of do it and get it on and it works. And it just – I knew – and then moved to Broadway and then wins the Tony Award. It just – I thought that's not going to happen again. So you know what? Let me just – put that Tony Award on my shelf and gaze at that and go home and take care of my kid was sort of how it went.
Why did you make a shift from theater?
The easy answer and the quick one is that we had a child. And Andre, my husband, now husband, partner then, but now we're married, was the artistic director of Lincoln Center Theater. And I just thought there was no way for both of us to have a really the careers that you need to have in the theater. Because you have to give 110% in theater. There's no other way to do it half.
How did you meet Andre?
I interviewed to be his assistant. And we had an incredible interview that where we both were like, wow, something was happening here. But, you know, it was work, so we were nothing did. And I didn't get the job because his assistant didn't end up leaving. But he left a message on the machine saying, well, there is no job, but let's get together for dinner sometime. And I thought, oh, wow, he must have felt it too.
And then you worked at Lincoln Center after.
I did, and that was a little tough. It was sort of exciting at first because no one knew about our relationship, and then it got annoying and hard after a while. That office romance stuff.
You're not the first.
Yeah, exactly.
You and Andre have been partners, and now he's your husband since when? Since
1991.
And you two have had kind of a personal entrepreneurial moment in having your daughter. Can you explain that?
We wanted a child, and, you know, so we sort of stumbled on an agency that was on 46th Street, and we did. But we also, when I look back, I think, wow, we kind of were out there on it. I think we're the first male couple in New York to adopt jointly.
And we take it for granted now because you have a lot of single-sex couples adopting, but you were the first.
Yeah, there are no – Katie has very few peers, and we're in New York. You know, we were always kind of the only two dads around for a long time. Now there's lots of them, which is great. Mm-hmm. But she's a real trailblazer, too. So she's got to sort of blaze that trail, too, and explain all the time as well.
After you left the theater world, before starting the company, you went back to college because you hadn't finished college. You only had a semester left, but you actually went to 4 years at Columbia.
I did. And
focused on architecture.
Right.
So was the thought that you would go into a career in architecture?
Well, I kind of knew that I wasn't going to go into a career in architecture, but I knew that I wanted to finish this degree that was unfinished, and I knew that I loved architecture, and I didn't quite know where it would go. When I got out, a friend who'd been incredibly successful in real estate said, I think you'd make a good developer. And I said, really? What's that? And he said, well, let's go find something and let's do a project together.
It's in Nolita, which is on the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
On Elizabeth Street.
Yeah. It's a building that people can't believe is new. Mm. It's brick and wood windows. And has a kind of detail and kind of heft that buildings used to have 100 years ago.
So why from theater to architecture to clothing? How did you land here?
I landed here because I did the development. It was the same. I was using the same exact skills in my developing the building that I was using in the theater. And I thought to myself, oh, I could do that clothing company that I've wanted to do literally since I was 10 years old. You know, there's a story. My mother, I was 10. We were driving in the car in Larchmont, New York, where I grew up. And I said, Mom, I want bell bottoms. And she said, oh, sweetie, I can't buy you bell bottoms because by the time I shorten them, they won't be bell bottoms anymore. Mm-hmm. And I remembered it as vividly as, you know, yesterday. And I thought, that's really not fair. It's like the proverbial bell bottoms is my rosebud. You know what I mean? So that's what I've been searching for.
Your earliest memories associated with knowing that you were gay also tie into a sartorial moment, a connection to clothes when you were a child.
Right. I have this vivid memory of my going up the third floor stairs with my older sister, who's, I guess, nine years older than me, and saying to her, you know what I love? I love waking up in the morning because I can't wait to get dressed. And I had this mustard pair of, like, pants that I loved. I remember my sister having a face on that was like, that's weird. You know, other five-year-olds are not saying that. And that doesn't mean you're gay, but I mean, it was, so I kind of always knew. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I hid it, and like lots of people did, and came out when I was 21, and everyone I knew was like, oh, really?
You had this love of style and clothes, you know, from the age of five. How about your parents?
My mother was really, you know, she dressed beautifully. You know, she knew that girl. You know, she taught at a girls' school, and she knew girls were watching. So she would pride herself on not wearing the same thing twice for, you know, weeks and weeks on times. She always looked put together and always managed to, you know, look great on without a lot of dough.
And why didn't you start this earlier?
I don't know. It didn't occur to me that I could. I mean, at the time, our building did very well, but the real estate market at the time had just dried up, and so I was sort of trying to figure out what was next. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to try and start this. And it's like this that thing, and that can happen. I sat next to someone at a dinner party who had a very successful career with the retail. And I told her that I've always had this idea. And she said, that's a great idea. Hmm. Call these people. They're starting a like kind of consulting firm for new brands. And you should really do that. That's a great idea. Hmm. And so off I went.
When you initially launched Peter Manning, where did the capital come from?
I was able to get a loan, $200,000. It was the first time the bank ever gave a loan to a startup.
What bank?
M&T Bank, mm-hmm. Because they believed in it. And so that's how I got started, because I was really at the moment where I was like, I can't, maybe I'm not going to pull it off. Maybe I'm not going to get there. And they approved the loan and I was like, we're off. Mm. We can do this. But then it's like, well, now you have to go raise more money. But now we've a proven concept and sort of real growth. And people can go, oh, wow, you really are onto something. When you're an entrepreneur, which I guess I am, I'm like the reluctant entrepreneur, sometimes you're so far out on a limb that you feel like it's going to break. You know, I've cried on street corners. Like, I don't know how I'm going to solve this. And then I remember that we're not curing cancer. We're just trying to sell some pants. Like, and you get through it, and everyone's going to live. And it, you know what I mean? So, when you feel so much and you want so much the right thing, you know.
Why have you cried on a street corner?
Okay, here's what. Chinos are a big part of our business. The chinos that came in right before we were to put them on sale came, and their back pockets were too shallow. Like, you couldn't get a wallet in them. All of them. So we had to send them back to the factory, and then they have to remake them. And they're like, ooh, sorry. I'm like, oh, sorry? Hmm. What? Didn't anyone ask? Like, these pockets don't seem right. Like, no one asked that question? And so I'm still waiting for those pants. They're currently in customs. I'm waiting for them to come. And so it's just brutal. I feel so deeply about my customer that it drives me crazy.
Your daughter, what role, if any, has she played in the founding of this company?
Well, it's funny you should ask. The New York Times did an article about me and the company in March of 2012. And at that time, she's in boarding school now, which she's an ice hockey player. And she'd gotten into the school, and we were going up for what is called the revisit. The weekend where you go and sort of go look at the school and decide whether you really want to go there or not. And that was the day that the New York Times article came out. Like, the New York Times article came out that morning, and we were in the car on our way 4.5 hours to New Hampshire for 2 days, and there was nothing I could do. And my BlackBerry is going, ping, 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 ping. And I'm thinking, I can't go to this school and, like, be one of those New York dads with my BlackBerry in the corner when everyone else is trying to, like, look like, oh, yes, we love it here and the trees are so pretty and, oh, so interested in this humanities class and, wow, the gym's great and the whole thing. And my BlackBerry is literally going to explode from, you know, orders that I'm getting. So I just said to Katie, I said, young lady, when you get home, you are going to work. And we came home, and because we were at the time, it was all in our house. Like, one day, a truck came and delivered all these boxes, and I lugged it upstairs.
In Manhattan.
And she, for 2 days straight, we just, for 12 hours, just like pushing it out. We'd push them out. I'd run to FedEx and drop them off. I mean, it was absolute insanity. I mean, a great lesson for a kid to sort of go, wow, this is how it works. You know, and I can see, too, sometimes when she's like, you know, the business, and it's like the other sibling.
It's competitive.
Yeah.
Do you ever see people on the street wearing your clothes?
I have, and it's so great. Just, you know, guy in a shirt and a khakis, and I just, you know, was driving, going by in a cab, and there he was. And I was like, there he is. He looks great. There's a very funny story. My daughter calls one day, and she's like, you're not going to believe it. This guy came up to me at school and said, hey, is your dad Peter Manning? And she said, yeah. And she's like, why? And she said, I wear his pants. It turns out she has a crush on him. So, you know what I mean? The whole thing is too weird, but very funny.
It struck me that, you know, here you are the producer of Sidemen, and Sidemen being musicians in jazz bands, and your career has been somewhat of a jazz song, you know, kind of ad hoc a little bit, you know, going from, you know, this beat to that.
Yeah.
Have you thought about that?
I had never made that connection, but it does make a lot of sense, and it's true. You know, in jazz, I sort of pick up the melody wherever it comes from, and in Sideman, there's a monologue where he talks about his father playing, and he said, you know, he'd be playing the horn, and if a car horn blew outside, he'd incorporate that into his solo. And I guess there's a little bit of that in my life, sort of here are these things, and these sort of allowing them to give them life, you know, from a play to a kid to a clothing company to a building.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's been great to be here.
My guest has been Peter Manning, the founder of the clothing company, Peter Manning. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.